There's endless stories that I've been hearing, especially of workers in the heartland who talk about how betrayed they feel, how left behind they feel. And this speaks to why we not only need to make work work, because we believe that all people should be able to work, live, and age with dignity, but why it's also important for people to have a voice and agency in all aspects of their lives, because this is what makes for a better democracy.
That's Sarita Gupta, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Sarita Gupta on the future of work. The future of work is unclear. There will be jobs, but what kind? The pandemic drove many to work remotely at home. As the crisis ebbs, some will discover that's the future. Crucial long-term factors affecting workers will be more and more AI, artificial intelligence, and automation. Corporations will be looking to expand in those areas to maximize profits. This is all happening while worker militancy has enjoyed a resurgence. Workers are challenging some of the biggest corporations. There's been a marked uptick in unionization, organizing, and strikes at such behemoths as Amazon, Starbucks, and Apple. Workers, who have seen wages stagnant for decades because of neoliberal economics, are demanding higher pay and better benefits. In this changing landscape, what will be the future of work? Our guest today is Sarita Gupta. She's known for her policy advocacy, organizing, and building partnerships across the workers' rights and care movements. As vice president of the Ford Foundation, she oversees all U.S. programs. Previously, she served as the executive director of Jobs with Justice. She's the author of The Future We Need, Organizing for a Better Democracy in the 21st Century. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And now, Sarita Gupta on the future of work.
When we think about the future of working people, it's really important that we think about the future, that their future is inextricably linked to our ability to promote and preserve equality and democracy. So two questions I want to explore. Is work working as it's currently formatted? And if not, how do we make work work? So I want to assert that work is not working for far too many people in this country. Before the pandemic and the economic recession hit, there were 64 million people who earned less than $15 an hour and could barely make ends meet, living paycheck to paycheck. Every day, they were making difficult choices, paying for rent, paying for food, paying for medicine, paying for diapers, whatever it be, but impossible choices. The pandemic and the economic crisis has laid bare the results of decades of growing inequality and compounded it, taking a disproportionate toll on the poor, people of color, immigrants, people with disabilities, and others who were already marginalized before the crisis. This pandemic has demonstrated the gross inadequacy of our existing social safety net and exposed inequities in access to basic needs for too many people, be it food or healthcare. And of course, during this pandemic, millions of people have died. And somehow we've lost that narrative in the story of the pandemic. But millions and millions of people have died and continue to die, many of whom are in fact workers. April 4th is an important day in our history because it's a day that we commemorate Martin Luther King Jr. And that was the day he was killed. He was killed, and a lot of people forget this, while supporting sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. At that time, Dr. King said, "Someday, our nation will realize that the sanitation worker is as essential as the physician, because all labor has dignity." Well, this, in fact, is what happened during the pandemic. The public took notice suddenly of essential workers. Essential workers, including the factory and agricultural workers, sanitation, delivery drivers, grocery store clerks, restaurant employees, and first responders, who have always kept society running and only were recognized as such during the pandemic and in name only. Because these same working people do not have the basic protections or bargaining power in their companies and sectors to voice concerns about their working conditions. They want and deserve wages that would allow a decent standard of living. They want access to benefits, paid leave, and health care. Too many have been forced to work without access to childcare, and in too many cases, left to work without safe and healthy working conditions. So even as frontline essential workers were hailed as heroes, they have and continue to be treated as expendable. So today, we are witnessing what many have termed as the Great Resignation. While some call this moment the Great Resignation, millions of workers feel that America quit on them a long time ago. For the last four decades, we've experienced the great, what I like to call the great stagnation of employers not meeting the needs of workers. A recent Pew Research report revealed that the wealth gap between America's richest and poorer families more than doubled from 1989 to 2016. That's not during a global health crisis. That's during so-called normal times. When the pandemic hit, that gap was electrified. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2020, the lowest wage workers lost 8 million jobs, while the highest wage workers gained nearly 1 million jobs. So the Great Resignation is not about a great quit. This is a historic moment of refusal. People aren't quitting right now to leave the labor force. They're quitting to take other jobs. Because workers don't want to accept anything less than living wages and benefits and safe working conditions. And we're in such an interesting cultural moment right now because workers across the economy are actually reflecting on and asking themselves, what is the purpose of work? What do I believe I want out of work? And, you know, it's fascinating. I've had the great privilege of meeting with lots of workers and talking to them. And there's always an older generation of workers who will say to me, I remember a time when I used to work in order to live a full life. I worked so I could be involved in my PTA or in my church or my synagogue or in my civic association, my neighborhood association. Today, I feel like all I do is live to work. And fascinatingly enough, young workers are saying the same thing, not around what they remembered of work, but more about they're questioning what is the purpose of work and can work actually be a vehicle by which they can do the many other things they want to do. So it's a really interesting cultural moment that people are asking themselves these questions, which creates lots of openings when we think about how we make work work. So millions of workers are leaving jobs and taking other ones because of ongoing health and safety concerns. That's the number one issue we hear. And because of COVID-related care responsibilities. It's important to remember that the lack of affordable and accessible childcare and school closures have contributed to this. The last set of numbers we saw were over 2.5 million women leaving the labor force because of the lack of a care infrastructure in this country. So while this is happening, workers leaving their jobs to find other ones, we're also seeing this incredible upsurge of workers taking collective action. Workers are organizing and forming unions right now. Starbucks workers have gathered unprecedented momentum in unionizing efforts following the flagship establishment of a union in Buffalo, New York, and then having branches across the country who are taking up the union fight. So far, at least, as far as I understand, there are six or more branches here in Oregon that have announced union drives, which is really exciting. And here in Eugene. And of course, there are 600 digital workers at the New York Times who just unionized, because forever the writers and the journalists had unions, but the digital workers never did. So again, it's a really interesting time. We just see this upsurge of organizing. And of course, last fall was termed Striketober. There were workers in manufacturing, filmmaking, healthcare, and other parts of the economy that were going on strike. We had, John Deere workers, auto workers, over 10,000 workers who went on strike, or workers at Kellogg's, Nabisco workers, and of course, healthcare workers and the Fight for 15, McDonald's workers. So actually what we're seeing right now is a great awakening. Workers are acting with their feet because work is just not working for far too many of them. So let's unpack this a little bit. How did we get here? Work as we know it is changing. It is being profoundly reshaped by the global pandemic. In addition to threats to public health, the economic and social disruptions threatens the long-term livelihoods and well-beings of millions. Yet well before the pandemic, shifts in work have been driven by forces such as globalization, demographic changes, technology, and climate change. So I just want to take a few seconds to talk about each. Globalization has helped accelerate a shift in how work is structured. In many advanced economies, the structure of work has shifted away from these mega firms of the past, which employed and provided benefits for large workforces across a range of skills and income levels. So think General Motors, for example, right? Or the Ford Company. Work is shifting towards more nimble firms who keep a light footprint when it comes to employment, offering permanent jobs to a relatively small number of high-end managers and engineers and other office staff, while relying on a fluid army of contingent workers for everything else. So think Uber or Instacart or many of the other companies like that. This trend towards what we call fissuring, it's a term that was coined by an academic under the Obama administration, the Wage and Hour, head of the Wage and Hour Division, David Weil. Essentially, firms are constructing networks of subcontracting, outsourcing, and franchising that allow them to streamline operations and cut costs, specifically labor costs, by avoiding the responsibility once attached to the standard employment relationship of the past. And as a result of this trend, we see a rise in contingent work, so work that is much more precarious and insecure. And we see an increase in the independent contractor classification, which matters in a legal context because in US labor law, they are excluded from collective bargaining rights since they're not employees. So what does this mean? This means millions of workers are excluded from basic labor standards. I'm going to say that again. Millions of workers are excluded from basic labor standards. And right now we face the threat of creating a whole new classification of gig workers who once again will be excluded from basic labor protections. So then you have demographic shifts. And around the world, we see expanding youth populations and aging populations in other parts of the world that are creating new pressures on labor markets and on social security systems. So here in the United States, we are in fact in the elder boom. People are turning 65 at a rapid rate in this country. And what that is resulting in is as people are turning 65 and older and setting towards retirement. They're living longer lives, which is a good thing and something we should celebrate. But what it has meant is it's put a pressure on our systems that were not created for such a large population of aging adults in this country. We don't have the kind of care system in place to truly support the ability for aging workers and aging people to age with dignity. And the result of that is a pressure on families. I am of the sandwich generation. I have a father who has Alzheimer's and a mother with severe mobility issues that I care for. I also have an 11-year-old daughter. And my husband and I literally feel like we're a panini, like we are squeezed between the needs of both ends of the spectrum, let alone our own health needs. Too many families are struggling right now to figure out how to support their care needs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, over the next few years, over 50% of the workforce will be caring for aging adults in their lives. Over 50%. And we do not have the care structure in place to support workers in being able to provide that kind of support. So this brings me to technology. While artificial intelligence, automation, and robotics will eliminate jobs, they're also poised to create new jobs. So the question is whether or not those new jobs will be good quality jobs that provide people with what they need to live sustainable lives. Job creation is truly critical for our economy. Yet often the discussion about job creation is framed as an either or. Either we create more jobs, or we create good quality jobs, but somehow we can't create both. Like we can't figure out how to make jobs better and create new ones. And so this moment is really, really critical for us to change that frame and to say it's a both and. We need good quality jobs that get created in our economy. More broadly, across geographies and sectors, labor activities and classifications, technology is reshaping work in ways that meet the needs of businesses and consumers alike without concern for workers' interests. That is deep, that we haven't thought about how we protect workers in the midst of such incredible technological change. And that finally brings me to climate change. The greening of our economies as we adopt sustainable practices and clean technologies will also create huge opportunities for new jobs. So again, how do we make sure these are good quality jobs? And other jobs will disappear as countries scale back their carbon and resource-intensive industries. So again, this question comes up of how do we create the pathways for workers who will lose jobs to acquire new skills that match the jobs for tomorrow? So all of these forces have been at play, and they're exacerbated by trends that are making our economy increasingly unequal, such as wealth concentration among the super rich. In the US, the top 1% holds more of the country's wealth than the bottom 90%. We see incredible market concentration right now, including the heightened power of tech monopolies, which contributes to wage stagnation, limits entrepreneurship, increases the cost of living, and stifles innovation. Growing financialization of the global economy is the third trend that is playing out, which is designed to maximize the value for shareholders versus society at large. So consequently, work has become increasingly precarious, unsafe, and unsustainable for millions of people. And here in the US, we see wage stagnation. Wages have remained stagnant and in some cases declining. So just to translate that, people at the 40th percentile of the income distribution, so think bank tellers or think preschool teachers, they saw their incomes grow by just 0.3% per year from 1980 to 2018. While those in the top 0.1% saw their already large incomes quadruple over the same time. So to further illustrate this point, we just talked about essential workers, and one category of essential workers have been care workers, domestic workers. 30% of domestic workers in this country who make so much of work possible were found to rely on public assistance for food security. That's what we're talking about, wage stagnation and massive inequality. Workers have limited access to basic protections and benefits in our country, where basic necessities such as health insurance and sick leave are tied to our work status. Too many workers lack access to such basics. For instance, while 90% of professional workers have paid sick leave, only 27% of food service workers do. These are the people handling our food. They don't have paid sick leave. And of course, the pandemic showed us what this meant in terms of paid family medical leave. We are the only industrialized nation that does not provide paid family medical leave to our population. And of course, outdated labor laws and protections in this country. Labor laws have not kept pace with changes in the nature of work. For instance, gig workers, who were said to make up somewhere between 25 to 35% of the pre-pandemic workforce, are often classified as contractors, which prevents them from accessing basic benefits. They also face unpredictable schedules and variable pay. So gig workers have no access to these benefits. And this, of course, was a big debate, if you remember, when around economic recovery and some of the early acts that were legislation that was passed to support workers as soon as the crisis hit. There were fights to make sure gig workers were included in some of those protections. But for workers who can collectively bargain, the game is rigged against workers who want to try to form a union and collectively bargain. Pushes to unionize often fail because employers can deploy a range of extreme union busting tactics and even break the law with very little repercussions. There's virtually no penalties for an employer who violates the law. You do not lose your license or your ability to bid for a government contract. You don't get any jail time, certainly. So, if there's no repercussions, why would they not, in fact, deploy union busting tactics? Employers have a lot of capital, and according to the Economic Policy Institute, employers spend approximately $340 million on union busting annually. I can go on about unions and union busting, but I'm going to keep us moving forward and just say that despite how hard it is for workers to form a union, most Americans support unions. A recent Gallup poll shows that 62% of people surveyed have a favorable opinion of unions. Yet the last 40 years has been really difficult for working people. I just shared a lot of stats with you. But I know this because I watched the impact of all of these dynamics on the community I grew up in. So a little bit about me. My family immigrated to the United States during a time when immigration doors were opened up for physicians because there was a physician shortage in this country for decades, especially in rural towns. This was about 10 years after Medicare and Medicaid was passed in 1965. So immigration doors were opened up to what were known as foreign medical graduates from around the world. So hence, we landed in Rochester, New York, otherwise known as Kodak City. Rochester is a mid-sized city in western New York. For those of you who don't know Rochester, it's situated on Lake Ontario and the Great Lakes bordering Canada. People in New York City call Rochester Canada, or they call us the Midwest. It's a long, you know, it's a sore spot in my family. My husband's from Brooklyn. It's really bad. But we were one of the early Indian families in Rochester, and my parents were really active in the Indian community, helping to establish an ethnic association and then eventually helping to open an Indian community center. Looking back now, I realize that that's where I got my organizing roots from. We never called them organizers, but they were in fact building community and support systems. And so this was important because we were different. Where I grew up, I was one of the few kids of color in my school. In the 1980s, Kodak began downsizing due to aggressive competition and then their failure to adjust to shift to digital photography. I lived one town over from Kodak Park, which is what we call the industrial facility of Kodak. I lived in a working class community where majority of the kids I grew up with had family members who had worked at Kodak for multiple generations. Most of my friends thought they would also end up at Kodak. Again, it's the largest employer, one of the largest employers in the area. They made decent money, they got benefits, and they were living a middle class life. Let me be clear, Kodak did not have a union. George Eastman believed he could take care of workers. He was in fact that kind of an employer. So it's interesting learning the history of Kodak, because in 1912, George Eastman, would introduce one of the most progressive and widespread profit-sharing programs in the history of corporate America. And then 7 years later, he offered employees nearly one-third of his personal stock at a price below the market rate. And then he used these proceeds to build and strengthen a welfare fund. And then Eastman later implemented paid sick leave, life insurance, disability coverage, a retirement annuity, paid college tuition, access to company-funded healthcare centers, and company housing. I share this because you can imagine when the company began laying off workers, there was very little that workers could do given they didn't have a union. And the first round of layoffs happened, I'm aging myself, when I was eight, in 1983. The company's employment in Rochester, just to give you a sense, plummeted from more than 60,000 workers 40 years ago to 4,500 workers today. The impact was devastating. I had a really good friend whose family had worked at Kodak for over three generations, and her mom lost her job there and couldn't find comparable work. She ended up taking a job as a school bus driver, making significantly less money and having way less benefits. I watched as my family's friends struggled to maintain a middle-class lifestyle. I always asked myself, literally, I was 8 years old, and I was like, how is this possible? How can families who have worked for generations at a company lose their jobs and their sense of security like this? It just didn't feel fair, and it didn't feel right. My friend was really determined to go to college and get out of Rochester, where she saw limited options for her future. And in fact, she worked really hard and figured out how to get into college and work through college and was in fact able to leave. And I wish I could tell you that this is a typical story of the kids I grew up with, but it isn't. Some families left Rochester in search of work elsewhere. But the majority stayed and found work in smaller manufacturing plants, which over time certainly went into decline. Or they joined the ranks of growing low-wage service workers, living with less financial security and more precarity. Just to give you a sense, like manufacturing in Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and that part of the Rust Belt, if you will, it was really horrible in the 90s as manufacturing was declining. The Rochester area had 124,000 manufacturing jobs in 1990, compared with 60,000 in 2012. And in 2020, it was literally ranked one of the worst job markets in the country, according to the Wall Street Journal. For many of my friends and their families, they felt and continue to feel left behind. As the layoffs continued over many years, I was confronted with the complexity of race and class. On the one hand, I was a brown kid in a school, and people assumed that my situation must be even worse than theirs, right? In fact, it wasn't, but that was the assumption. And on the other hand, it became so clear to me how easy it was for them to scapegoat others. it was the fault of workers in other countries. Then it was the fault of immigrants and workers of color taking away jobs and opportunities. And these sentiments started then and remain in place as I read Facebook feeds of the kids I grew up with today.
You're listening to Sarita Gupta on the future of work. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
We see a lot of divisions in America today. Growing anger and frustration. People feel left behind by employers, by politicians, and in this case in Rochester, they missed out on having a union or an organization that could have advocated for their collective interests. Some of the kids I grew up with headed to DC on January 6th to protest the election and more, because they've lost faith in our democracy and the role of our government. They've bought into the narratives that people of color and immigrants are taking something away from them. Others have died or watched loved ones die of the opioid crisis. It is therefore not surprising that they feel a real lack of respect, dignity, and agency in their lives. This didn't just happen in Rochester, right? It happened in communities around the country. And there's endless stories that I've been hearing, especially of workers in the heartland who talk about how betrayed they feel, how left behind they feel. And this speaks to why we not only need to make work work, because we believe that all people should be able to work, live, and age with dignity, but why it's also important for people to have a voice and agency in all aspects of their lives, because this is what makes for a better democracy. But at the moment we are in now, there's an immense opportunity for us to forge a really different path forward. We can actually ask ourselves, how do we make work work? The combination of the pandemic and the crisis and the trends and the cultural moment where people are asking themselves about work creates this opportunity. And over many years, I had the privilege to work with leaders and organizers in Jobs at Justice and with unions and worker centers to really learn about the different strategies and ways that we can forge ahead. And so as much as I shared this really sad story about the city I grew up in, I'm actually an incredibly hopeful person, because I do think there's opportunities to make change, but we need to do it quickly. Because at the end of the day, whether it was workers at Verizon who are bargaining for a better contract, or it was workers at Smithfield or workers at Walmart organizing, or it was day laborers or domestic workers, all the campaigns I've been involved in, they all wanted the same thing: respect, dignity, and agency. And they wanted to be able to sustain themselves and their families and get a fair return on their work. So unions and emergent movements of workers outside of unions have been doing incredible organizing. And so that's what I want to share a little bit about now. I have a book coming out. It's called The Future We Need, Organizing for a Better Democracy in the 21st Century. And the premise of the book is that collective bargaining has to be expanded beyond workplaces to support a healthy political and economic multiracial democracy. The second is that, given all the changes I just talked about, it is critical that we modernize collective bargaining rights to meet the needs of modern workers. And thirdly, we have to confront white supremacy and patriarchy, because they are central to our labor movement. They're not adjacent to it. They are central, because workers have complex intersectional identities, and frankly, it's the only way we're going to win progress in this country. If my story about Rochester doesn't point out that if we could address the economic pain points and connect it back to a healthy democracy, there's so much we can achieve in this country. So let me talk a little bit and share a few examples of what I mean by modernizing collective bargaining rights. And this is how we make work work. We actually need to expand how we think about bargaining. We need to forge new ways of organizing and bargaining that really is appropriate to a world in which power is concentrating in the hands of fewer economic actors. At its best, collective bargaining is a system by which working people can exercise collective power in a way that directly confronts the owners of capital, right? And reclaims a portion of that capital for working people in their communities. Collective bargaining allows everyday people to practice democracy, directly engaging in the decisions that affect their lives. Collective bargaining affects our lives beyond work sites as well. Workers have a stake in the ability to come together collectively, not only as employees, but also in the myriad of other ways working people play a role in the economy. Tenants, debtors, homeowners, consumers, and many others have joined together to confront and negotiate with specific forces of capital, whether it's corporations, banks, student loan companies, and elements of the state to ensure dignified lives for themselves and their families. Therefore, we have to expand our definition of bargaining to be about creating pathways for working people to come together collectively to negotiate with any entity that has power over their lives, right? Employers, landlords, financiers, and much more. And in the context of workplace bargaining, we need to shift the very nature of what a union contract covers, broadening what individuals can negotiate over and who they can negotiate with, and really understand from their direct boss to the individuals with concentrated power in their sector or in their community. So let me unpack this a little bit, because today workers are confronting this question. Most workers don't actually know who their real bosses are. Let's be real. Most workers aren't sure what they're allowed to bargain over. And many workers have no experience of governing over other aspects of their lives. So we have a lot of work to do. So who is the real boss? The best example of this is McDonald's workers. So McDonald's workers go to franchises and they say, we want better wages, we want better working conditions, health and safety issues are important, et cetera. And the franchise owner says, well, I'm not the one who sets those standards. That gets done by headquarters. So then the workers go to the headquarters who say, well, we're not the ones who make that decision. The franchise owners do. And in that process, it's a shell game for workers, right? So what do we learn from that? We actually need to take the demands to the ultimate profiteer. We need to expand frameworks beyond employers themselves. So I'm going to share an example of this. For years, Driscoll's supplier, Sakuma Brothers' berry growing operation in Washington State, employed immigrants and long-term residents from southern Mexico to pick berries and live in company-provided housing during the harvest season. The immigrants were largely indigenous people who spoke languages other than Spanish as their first language. And in 2013, berry pickers at Sakuma Brothers began protesting low pay and bad working conditions. When the company fired the leaders, many of the other workers began a strike against the company and eventually organized into Familias Unidas por la Justicia to bargain on their behalf. Sakuma Brothers retaliated by greatly expanding their request for H-2A guest worker visas. And at the same time, Sakuma told the people who had engaged in the strike against them that they were terminated, something they actually could do because farm workers were not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. However, workers unleashed an even bigger weapon against Sakuma. First, each of the workers, I love this, they wrote a letter to the U.S. Department of Labor refuting Sakuma's claim that it was unable to find workers in the U.S. by saying, hey, I'm willing to work there, right? Second, they organized a boycott against Driscoll's, who is the ultimate profiteer. The upside of not being covered by the National Labor Relations Act was that there was nothing to prevent them from organizing a secondary boycott of Driscoll's to win concessions from Sakuma. Because if you're covered under the National Labor Relations Act, you're not allowed to engage in secondary boycotts. So other unions respected the boycott against Driscoll's, including the Longshoremen's Union, which one day refused to load any Driscoll's berries onto ships. In addition, the union organized student protests and consumer boycotts of Driscoll's, which was another key step that they took, which is particularly important for workers today, especially in a global industry such as agriculture, was that the workers reached out to their counterparts in Mexico, their country of origin, to ask them to join in the action against Driscoll's. The workers in both countries set up a binational front to launch a strike and a boycott. All of this pressure brought Sukuma to the table. Despite the lack of any legal protections for the workers, Sukuma agreed to negotiate with the union in 2016, and in 2017, they agreed to collective bargaining agreement. So another category is what we can bargain over. How do we embrace that bargaining can be a site of struggle? This is really important. Sometimes we think of collective bargaining as something that happens in a room between a group of workers and their employers, yet bargaining can be a really powerful site of struggle, as we are seeing through the emergence of the Bargaining for the Common Good Network. This is a network of unions and community-based organizations coming together using traditional bargaining to raise issues broader than what is permissible under law. In terms of topics to the table. The recent set of teacher strikes are great examples of this. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the teachers in their around their bargaining table said, "We have a lot of immigrant students. We do not want immigration raids happening in the schools and in our community." And they won that in their agreement. Or Chicago Teachers Union, who together with the community fought and struggled. These were really public campaigns and won housing assistance for homeless students and families. These are issues that technically under the law are not the issues you can bargain over. But more and more workers are using their bargaining power to actually bring a broader set of issues in the community to the table. And that campaign is continuing across the country in the public sector and now beginning in the private sector with bank workers, actually, which is really fascinating. So then the third is who can bargain? There are sets of workers who've been excluded from the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standard Act. I talked about independent contractors, but way before that, when the New Deal was being negotiated, and the National Labor Relations Act was being negotiated, there was a compromise between politicians in the South who represented the interests of plantation owners and politicians in the North. And the agreement was that they would exclude domestic workers and agricultural workers, all of whom at that time were Black, many of whom, majority of whom were Black workers. It's a legacy of slavery that is still with us today. These workers are still excluded from these basic protections. So the question is, what can they do? And who can bargain? If the law says they can't bargain, applying frameworks of bargaining, because the labor movement has been the most successful in bargaining agreements that truly created pathways for people to be in the middle class, to make their way into the middle class, stay in the middle class. So why wouldn't we want to leverage that tool, that strategy, that ability? So how do we apply the frameworks of bargaining to other economic relationships? We have to start shifting the conversation on collective bargaining and talking about how to transform collective bargaining from the margins as a thing that unions do, which, by the way, is way less than 10% of our population today, right? To something that everyone seeks in all their economic relationships as a fundamental characteristic of democracy. This is important to make a connection between the person, the job, and their whole life. You know, for a long time, I have been working and supporting home care workers, unions, SEIU and AFSCME, who'd been organizing home care workers for many years, trying to create new strategies for bargaining. But I also had the opportunity to support domestic workers. These were largely home care workers. These are nannies. These are house cleaners and elder care providers who are hired by private households, right? So they're not employed through a big company or the state. They are literally employed by individuals. So the question was, how do you win rights for these workers? And I remember I talked about the aging population and the need for a care infrastructure. We don't have childcare, et cetera. Well, what's been fascinating in the last few years is that the Caring Across Generations campaign really attempted to bring together care workers with families who needed care and individuals who needed care to say together, let's stop pitting workers' interests against families' interests or individuals' interests. Let's actually demand a different system where we can all get what we need. And so what's been so fascinating in crafting a campaign like that is when you embed workers' rights as part of a bigger common good strategy, it's so much easier to make progress. It's not easy, I didn't say, but easier to make progress. So under the Obama administration, we did in fact win the home care rule, where 2 million home care workers were afforded overtime and minimum wage protections. Again, these are workers that are not covered by the Fair Labor Standard Act. And since then, workers have continued to organize alongside recipients of care to together demand a whole new care system. And so the pandemic happens, and what happens? Suddenly, people are talking about a care economy. Let me tell you, as an organizer, when I first mentioned the language of care economy, people would laugh me out of a room. What's the care economy? Because it was invisible. People didn't want to talk about the invisible labor in our economy. Today, people are fighting for childcare. People are fighting for care infrastructure. But this didn't happen by accident. It did happen because of the great work of unions like SEIU and AFSCME, but it also happened because of the bold and innovative strategies of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So in the last 10 years, the National Domestic Workers Alliance advocated and won basic protections and standards for house cleaners and care providers all over the country through bills of rights. They passed the first New York State Bill of Rights for domestic workers, and then it's kind of spread around the country, creating and setting standards. And when I say standards, I mean wage standards, days off, ability to have vacation, sick leave, et cetera. But more importantly, as they won these campaigns, they started to win what were called standards boards. So in Seattle, the first domestic workers standard board was created. This standards board brought together domestic workers with industry leaders and the state to negotiate together on the standards for domestic workers. So why is this important? Because again, without this kind of an innovation of how you start setting standards and frankly start to amalgamate workers, it gets you on the path to what could be bargaining, right? And then most recently, NDWA launched their partner organization called NDWA Gig Worker Advocates to launch a first of its kind pilot program to advance workers' interests on a gig platform. So this organization was launched by the domestic workers movement to improve the quality of jobs for gig economy workers. Handy, which is an online marketplace for home cleaning, installation, and other home services, and the biggest online cleaning dispatcher, came together to create, it's the first time actually an advocacy organization and a gig economy company came together to negotiate an agreement. The pilot program extends to Handy Pros, which is what the workers are called, in the states of Florida, Kentucky, and Indiana, who book cleaning jobs on the Handy platform. What they won was $15 minimum base pay, substantive part-time off benefits, roughly the equivalent of 17 paid days off for someone who works 40 hours, which is obviously more than the minimum law, a contractual monthly process for Handy Pros and the company leaders to raise, discuss, and address problems that workers are experiencing on the platform, And they won this in states that, frankly, right now have very difficult legislative terrains, Florida, Indiana, and Kentucky, and where the labor movement has less political power than they once had. NDWA carefully architected this pilot so as not to disrupt or contradict other moving strategies in the gig economy, because many unions are trying to figure out how to negotiate. But they were able to be completely bold and innovative while being really conscientious and in solidarity with the rest of the labor movement. It's a victory for thousands of workers, nearly all women of color, who are denied even the minimal protections of traditional labor and employment law. So why is this? It's inspiring that we can have that. This is a group of workers who, again, under the law, don't have these rights, but have figured out how to innovate. And in that process, work with SEIU. Now, actually, SEIU and NDWA have a whole pilot program together where they're organizing home care workers together in some key states. The truth is, this is not a new strategy, because actually, this is the strategy of the building trades, right? Building trades back in the day had hiring halls, created guilds, figured out how to amalgamate workers and bargain contracts and have prevailing wage standards set. That's exactly what domestic workers are doing. So there's so much. Sometimes we have to look back at history to remember that sometimes what didn't work 20 years ago could maybe work today given the changing conditions. And similarly, these kinds of standards boards I talked about with domestic workers are forming around the country, and wage boards are forming around the country. In fact, in Harris County, Texas, so near Houston, in Houston, essential workers were able to come together in that city, in that county, sorry, and establish a standards board where they are negotiating with the state and with a set of employers around health and safety standards, minimum pay, and sick leave issues. So this is starting to take root, and this is what we need more of, right? Because here's the thing, workers cannot wait for the laws to change. And laws don't change without workers being in struggle and in motion. And that's what's so exciting about this moment. We see the burgeoning of sectoral bargaining ideas and frameworks. But the point here is workers are in motion, and there's a huge opportunity for us to create real change. But we have to really shift how we think about our current laws and the idea of bargaining, which brings me back to democracy. Because our movement must also tend to the fundamental work of revitalizing democracy, because working people cannot improve their lives without gaining an effective collective voice in shaping their work on and off the job. Democracy is more than political voice. It's got to be more than what we do once every 4 years, right? To vote. And we know there's enormous attacks on our democracy, enormous attacks on voting rights in this country. And there is a group of people who really believe in minority rule. They do not believe in democracy. It is imperative that we understand that democracy is not only about political democracy, but has to be about economic democracy as well. When we can forge economic and political democracy together, that is when we can overcome the stark polarity that we see in our country today and remind people of the daily habits of democracy and why it's important for us to be fighting for and preserving and strengthening our democracy as we know it. So in closing, I just want to say, in this moment of great change, nothing is inevitable in what this means for the livelihoods and overall well-being for people and for workers. We are making choices every day. The choices we make as a people, as a nation, as industries, will shape this moment and the experiences of workers and society for generations to come. We are facing many choices. We can decide that we're going to let others imagine a future that continues to benefit a handful of people, or we can imagine and act on a future that benefits us all for generations to come. But it's up to us, right? All of us in this room and many others, to keep our eyes on the prize, to let our imaginations run wild right now, and to push beyond the existing structures and limitations and really imagine a tomorrow and take the risks today to get us to the full democracy that we all deserve. Thank you.
You were just listening to Sarita Gupta on the future of work. She spoke at the University of Oregon Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics. Sarita Gupta is known for her policy advocacy, organizing, and building partnerships across the workers' rights and care movements. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.